This is a production from the Yak Podcasting Network. The home for your growing sonic map of local voices united in their commitment to the best in podcasting.
Yo, welcome everybody to another edition of the Ticket City Podcast. I'm Jeff Ketchum, host of the podcast, joined today by the entire Orange Bloods ensemble. Anwar, Alex, Dustin, Jason, we are all here. And we've got some football stuff to talk about. The new Texas football coaches, along with Tom Herman, meeting with the media earlier this week. We've got some recruiting stuff to talk about. We'll talk maybe a smidge of basketball, baseball. There's a lot to get to. Let's start with the coaches' interviews from just a couple of days ago. Interesting in that it was our first chance to get to know the new guys a little bit. Anwar, I'll come to you first. Your general impressions, it's been a couple of days, so not quite 48 hours later, but I guess there's two parts of it, right? There's the talking to Tom part, which you've done a million times, and then there's the talking to the new guys. What stood out to you?
I think, you know, of course, the new guys, right? So you got to, you know, start with the coordinators and work kind of way down. You know, just kind of interesting to hear the thought processes of concepts, things to that effect. And like when you talked about like a guy like Chris Ash, and you kind of noted, I think it was you or maybe it's Brian Davis, something like that, him using the words like championship, which, you know, you don't necessarily hear where, you know, you talk about like this one and no mentality, but him talking about the importance of having a strong defensive line. And it's kind of interesting because that seems to be the thing that we talk about quite often, especially in the podcast, is getting strong defensive linemen. I'm always asking like, hey, well, you know, when's the last great defensive lineman that's kind of run through here? You know, it's like Malcolm Brown. And then there's been guys who have overachieved for sure, like a Puna Ford, but the elite guys. So knowing that there's going to be that emphasis on getting those guys in there, I thought was really interesting from Ash. That kind of correlates a little bit to the position changes that we heard about as far as like Osai and is concerned. So I thought that was interesting. I thought the compliments of the DB room was very interesting. I think Ash had said something to the effect of there's tons of guys in there who can start. I'm paraphrasing, but he basically called it, you know, the deepest DB room that he's ever coached. And yeah, that's always interesting when, you know, you're like, well, you coached a national championship team and you're really impressed by this talent. You know, the other thing, and I won't filibuster this, but I found it, there's a thing that I put in the war room that was really interesting from Jay Valai as he was talking about Ash, because I was kind of asking him about like how their relationship developed. And the one thing that I keep hearing about Ash is he's an extremely hard worker, like extremely hard worker, extremely organized, extremely detailed. Like that comes up a lot. And the one thing Valai told me was that when he was at Wisconsin as a player and Ash only coached him for 1 year, Ash actually was sleeping out of the office. And, you know, not like that, oh, he got there early and got there late. Like, literally, he had a blow-up mattress. It just would not leave the office. So he slept in there for, like, 3 months straight. And so that kind of speaks to, one, insanity, but two, his work ethic. That just seems to be a thing that really pops out. It really stands out, you know, about him. And then, you know, when it comes to Yurcich, you know, of course, you know, I had to ask my Mike Gundy question because, you know, I like Mike Gundy. But just hearing all the things that he said, like, you know, he kind of learned, you know, from him, kind of hearing a little bit about what his offensive concepts are. And you know, the other thing that stood out is, you know, the main reason he took this job was because of Sam. And that was his, like, the main thing is, like, he gets a chance to work with Sam. And then, you know, so you start imagining in your head, okay, well, this is what he's been able to do with other quarterbacks. What can he do with a guy like Sam Ellinger heading into an important senior year? So I'll stop there. But those are just some initial impressions.
You know, it's interesting you brought up Yurcich and Gundy. I didn't say anything about this on Tuesday when I think I saw these comments in Jason's live notes thread when he – Yurcich spoke first and then I think Ash went second. And when it, correct me if I'm wrong, when he was asked about Gundy, it seemed like he mostly spoke about I don't want to say necessarily non-football things, but like I'm looking at what Jason wrote right now, and he talked about work-life balance and how they all strive for that in the profession. And
then he I noticed that too, Ketch. It was, sorry to jump in, but it wasn't like X's and O's and this thing. It was, it was about like balancing your life and your family life.
Relationships with people.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting.
Treats players and coaches extremely well. It didn't, at least, and so I'm asking you, Anwar, because it may be that there was a side discussion or something that he went more into these things, but it didn't seem like, at least in reading the way Jason transcribed what was said at the press conference that was aired on the Longhorn Network, that he mentioned a lot of football stuff, specifically with Gundy. That stood out to me a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, clearly, that's the portion that I was expecting to hear, right, was the, oh, well, we learned this X and O's, and that's what I was getting at, right, and, you know, was the – this is how we develop talent, you know, at Oklahoma State, and this is what I plan to bring in here. And it definitely was a little bit different, right? Just and I don't think that was a slight at all, but I don't know the guy well enough to speak on that, so I didn't take it that way. But it was a very interesting takeaway as far as what he felt like he learned from them.
Well, and I thought it was somewhat interesting. I didn't necessarily mean it as a slight either. It was what was said in terms of like what stood out to him. It also, I don't feel like is a side of Gundy that we hear talked about a lot. Like, you know, Gundy's had a lot of success and kind of done it his own way and had all these interesting obstacles that he's dealt with in ways that other coaches and other programs haven't quite been able to do to win consistently. But that's not the stuff that I feel like we typically hear with Gundy. We all know he's a man, he's 40, and you know that whenever it comes to talking about his relationships with players and stuff like that, often I think that gets referenced first and foremost. But I don't know, interesting to get that perspective. Alex, I'll come to you from talking to the assistant coaches for the first time and picking their brains on various things. Like, what stood out to you?
Well, I just a couple things from the coordinators. I mean, one main thing that stood out to me, and Anwar already touched on it, but boy, man, when Ash said that secondary room is the best one he's ever stepped into, I just got to thinking about it. I even asked Anwar after the thing was over. I'm like, wasn't he on that Ohio State championship team? And wasn't that Eli Apple and Marshawn Lattimore and Vaughn Bell and just all these? I mean, that's a. Like he's coached, he's been in some good DB rooms. So that is one thing that really, really stuck out to me is the, you know, the talent level that he sees there. I'll be very interested to see what a pure DB's coach can do with some of these guys like the, you know, the Jalen Greens, the Anthony Cooks, you know, Deshaun Jameson, and of course the safeties, because off the hoof, if you do walk out onto a football field and just see these kids, you say, wow. Yeah, I mean, I'd love to get my hands on them as a DB's coach, or I can only imagine how a DB's coach would think about them. And then as far as Yurcich, one thing, I mean, it sounds like a platitude, and I know it's just more like a coach speak kind of deal, but when he talks about Sam Ehlinger and he says, you know, what he really loves is that's a guy who – and see, this is something that as people that have, like, watched Sam for 3 years, like – you know, the development when it happens right in front of you, it's like, you know, when your kids, like if you're like their aunts or something, they don't see them for like their aunt doesn't see them for like half a year and they see him again and they're like, holy shit, look how much bigger they've gotten. But to you, they just look kind of the same because you see him every day. And it's all, you know, when a new set of eyes gets on Sam Ehlinger, what Yurcich talks about is says like, look, this is a guy who, if people aren't at practice, he goes up, he shows up in there to, I don't remember the exact words, but he goes and gets them from the dorms. Like he handles punishment. He's the enforcer. And that's something that we've kind of a little bit waited on from Sam. And when he's taken that final step this year, it just reminded me a ton of how it was with Vince Young. And whenever he said, you know, and you got a guy in the program, a young guy like Hudson Card, who can look up to that, who can see that, who can see how important that is from a quarterback. I'm not saying we're about to go back to the days of Vince and Colt, because I'm, you know, that would be cockamamie, but it kind of reminded me of that, a little bit of that leadership in the quarterback room that should be being passed down now through osmosis. As far as the assistants, I think I was most impressed with Coach Hagan, man, the defensive line coach. Really love, you know, his insight he was able to give the way he sees these players, the way he sees his defense changing up the way – or the way that he sees his defensive philosophies along the defensive line changing up basically fundamentally the way that this defense attacks, being more of just a one-gapping, gap control, let these dudes pin their ears back and go. They're big, awesome-looking kids. Let's use that athleticism. Let's let them have some fun with it. And when you tell them about this, they're not going to have to be eating up these blockers, and they're not going to be having to take on double teams and two-gapping all the time. This could be a one-gapping, penetrating defense where we can allow the defenders to use their athleticism and their skill to push that, you know, line of scrimmage backwards and let the linebackers come downhill and see what happens from there. He says that's something that gets that front seven smiling, and that's something that, you know, it's something he's fired up and excited to hear about, and it's true. When I asked him, I said, so don't you think it's easier to move from a 3-4 to a 4-3 than it would be to move from a 4-3 to a 3-4. Not necessarily, because he did say it is a little bit hard to move to a 3 to a 4-3 just because finding that weak side defensive end is sometimes a little bit, that weak side defensive end jack position is sometimes a little bit tough. But see, in this spot, it's not tough because you've got Taylor made for it, like Joseph Osai. So if you take that and you bring it off the table, the rest of the install is super simple. It's like, look, run up that B gap, penetrate the shit out of that thing. Let the linebacker come spill behind you, and let's create some havoc here behind the line of scrimmage. And you can just tell from talking to him, it gets you a little bit fired up, and you know that it gets those players fired up.
And I just to piggyback off what Alex said, to jump back in, yeah. The guy who impressed me a lot through the conversation was Andre Coleman. And it was really fascinating because we were able to really get into – there's multi-layers, you know, to the Coleman story, but, you know, he talked about how tough it was and a little bit humbling it was like last year to not have a coaching job, to feel like, hey, I'm good enough to be a coach, but yet here I am as an analyst, and then having to take a role, you know, at Texas as an analyst where it's very specific. Like, you have a job to be an analyst and that's it. And Herman does not allow guys who are analysts to really overstep boundaries and rock the boat, right? If there's anything that seems like there could be like insubordination, you're out. So, you know, he talked about like, hey, you can't say anything, you know, you're just basically having to, you just kind of go and do your job and kind of watching. And just think about that from like a human aspect and a human point. Like, maybe you're watching, you know, he's going there and maybe he's watching practice thinking like, okay, I can do this or that. And knowing that you can't do anything, you can't say anything. And then the transition that occurs when he finally gets the opportunity, and he talked about like, he viewed it as an audition. Like, this would be his opportunity to basically get a job here at Texas. And, you know, and I reported on this back in December in one of these war rooms, but, you know, he started doing and implementing things within the drills for the receivers that they just had not done, things that he just had not been doing. And the guys really liked and gravitated to what I asked him about it. And then he said, like, he was doing things specifically to game plan for Utah. So his drills and the things that he was working on was specific on how to exploit Utah's weaknesses, at least the things that he saw on film. And then, you know, it's very interesting that Herman, I think we talked about the, you know, on the way out, you know, Colin Johnson and Devin Duvernay were the guys who said, hey, they gave him a thumbs up, and clearly he's not hiring them because those guys gave him a thumbs up, but it stood out to him. And then knowing that how those guys, the whole receiver room just kind of gravitated towards him, knowing that he's a former player. You know, I'll have more in the war room, but there's multi-layers to him as far as like how, you know, how he intends to deal with receivers and divas. He's like, I was a diva at one time myself, but if anyone thinks they're going to get anything given to them, they're just not. And I'm going to let them know. And if they, you know, fall in line, then they'll play. If not, then they won't. It's just going to be that simple. So there was also this, I know this position. You're not going to punk me. You're not going to talk down to me. I'm not going to deal with your shit, but I'm going to give you respect. So Andre Coleman was the guy that I spent a lot of time with, and I was very impressed.
Onward, I thought Coleman reminded me, and this reference will probably be lost on just about everybody because it really goes back like 20 years, but he's a very Daryl Drake kind of attitude in that it really came across that ass kissing isn't like among his priorities, and that keeping his job and maintaining his job and like being able to consistently have a career is first and foremost at like the top of his priorities, like not you know, playing favorites, but playing the best, because ultimately, as you mentioned earlier, this is a guy that was out of coaching a year ago. So by any means necessary, I'm guessing that's not where he wants to go back. And it'll be interesting to see how those wide receivers adjust to that. A little bit of like toughness and tough love may be exactly what that group needs after, I don't know what we would describe the Drew Maringer era as the wide receiver coaches thing, what that was.
You also had Drew and Corby Meekins too. You know what I'm saying? So, yeah. I mean, like there is a difference. I think it's when it comes to receivers, there's a difference where there's been a guy that's played a position. Oh, and by the way, a guy who's played in a Super Bowl, you know what I'm saying? Or which you can see a highlight of him scoring, you know, like you're going to listen to that guy because you get the idea that, okay, he knows what he's talking about. He's not telling me what he thinks. He's telling me what he knows from his playing experience, because he got to where I want to get to. So, you know, that portion of it would be very interesting.
I always feel like with the wide receivers sometimes that the wide receiver coaches sometimes try to be too cool instead of like just being, I don't know. Like I know that once upon a time, Texas had a bunch of diva wide receivers with Roy Williams and BJ Johnson and Sloane Thomas and the like. And the guy that got the most out of them was a guy in Darryl Drake, who ended up having a lot of success coaching in the NFL after leaving Texas. But he was one of these guys that just didn't put up with a lot of BS and didn't put up with their diva. They may have been divas, but they weren't divas around him. And it may be what that wide receiver room needs. Probably always be divas, because it's kind of what comes with the position. But when it's time to go to work, having a bit of a taskmaster to drill those guys around may be needed. Dustin, it's funny. I wanted to go back to something that Ash said about the defensive backs, because that was one of the comments that Alex mentioned that stood out to me, was that it was, you know, the most talented room. I think the exact line was that it was there were more starting level players in the Texas DB room than any room he had ever been in at any school in any situation. And the first thing that I thought of was the Tom Herman remark about the offensive line in 2017 and how it reminded him of the Ohio State offensive line in 2014. And that didn't quite work out. But the other thing that stood out was this was a group a year ago that we all thought that about. That, you know, I remember putting together my preseason all Big 12 team, and it was like, well, look, man, how do you fit in all the potential candidates? You've got Brandon Jones and Caden Stearns and BJ Foster, and who knows how good Jalen Green or an Anthony Cook might be at cornerback. And they're like all these names of big name recruits. So once upon a time before last season, we all believed that, at least most of us, that the defensive back room was the strongest on campus. It also felt like a hell of an indictment on the coaches that were here a year ago, that position was such a disaster last year that, you know, there was a time in the middle of the season when it didn't seem like they were doing anything right. And Chris Ash came in and audited the defense. So he, before he ever got the job, he knew what was on this team and on the defensive side of the ball, that he kind of went into Tuesday hyping up his group with a claim, with maybe even a little bit of hyperbole, given that nobody in that group a year ago proved to be a true standout. It felt like there were all kinds of little messages inside of that.
Yeah, it did. And I don't think he's wrong. I mean, I know he's been on some teams at Ohio State that had definitely more established star power and guys that went on to the NFL and had really, really successful careers and first round picks and so on. But you know, it's a group that you look at the recruiting classes recently and you look what we all thought, generally speaking, kind of heading into the season about just the depth and the versatility and the talent. And I don't think he's wrong when you look top to bottom of that group of just like you can kind of go through and like, okay, yeah, I can see this guy starting the game. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so many of these guys have had to start games because of injuries and other things like that. So, yeah, it was an interesting comment. You know, just him. He's clearly, you know, like all these coaches, kind of gone through and really taking a deep dive on the roster to see what exactly is there. And it's one of the things I think is the most underrated aspect about hiring basically a new coaching staff is you get a fresh set of evaluation eyes everywhere. You know, there's not really those predetermined scouting reports or I've recruited this guy and I think he does this best or this or that. I mean, these guys are coming in with fresh eyes, just trying to figure out, okay, where's my talent and how do I use these guys? And it's obvious that Ash was very, very pleased to inherit the defensive back group that he's going to have. But at the same time, like you said, it's almost like he was watching these guys and wondering why didn't they get more out of these guys last season, you know? And then you kind of look at the roster moving forward and it's strangely turned into like a make or break type of junior season for so many of these highly rated guys. But it's obvious that he came in and immediately identified, hey, we've got a lot to work with here if we can just put these guys in the right position. And I think it supports the recruiting and just the general thought that is one of the most talented, if not the most talented position group on campus, but they haven't gotten the production out of those guys. And, you know, another set of evaluation eyes and, you know, guys coaching the defense, perhaps they'll be able to get that out of them. But it's obvious that he knows that he's got something to work with those guys.
Slight transition. I thought one of the newsier things, moments to come out of Tuesday were just some of the personnel notes from the day, certainly on the defensive side of the ball. We hear, and I'll just throw some of them out there, and then let's just talk about them. You've got B.J. Foster undergoing shoulder surgery. I didn't get at a specific time. It sounds like it still needs to happen and that there was some, I don't know, inflammation or just issues with the nerve that they needed to have calmed down before they can do that. And long story short, unavailable for the spring. Herman mentioned that by the start of summer workouts, it's thought that he would be cleared, but I got to be honest, that is a bit worrisome for me that like, I just worry that we're not ever going to see the B.J. Foster that at his optimal level could exist. Once a guy starts having shoulder surgeries and issues, it is concerning to me. I'm old enough to remember Brian Pickerel being maybe outside of a guy like Brian Arakpo, the most talented defensive end that Mack Brown ever recruited. And his career was over before it could ever really get started because of these shoulder injuries that sometimes just never go away. So you've got the B.J. Foster thing. You've got also in the secondary, Ash singling out both Josh Thompson and Chris Brown as two players that he was really interested in. I'll let you guys that talked to him or heard those quotes specifically, we can talk about the context that they were made in, but feels like Josh Thompson would be a guy that might be battling B.J. Foster potentially for playing time in a nickel role, although he mentioned he might play some cornerback, which maybe it just sounds like he's trying to find a way to get Josh Thompson on the field. We all know that Chris Brown, when he was healthy a year ago, a bit of a surprise because he didn't come into last year with all the hype, but when he was healthy, may have played the best of any defensive back on the team when he was healthy. DeMarvion Overshown spins down to linebacker. And then Alex, I thought maybe the most interesting little personnel note of all on the defensive side of the ball was the admission that Taquan Graham may be more of a three technique in this defense than a strong side defensive end, which if he goes there in the spring and plays at the three tech, suddenly all of the defensive tackles as a whole, including the nose tackles and the guys that will play in that three tech with Mauro Ajomo specifically, suddenly it feels like they've got more depth inside. And suddenly outside of Joseph Osai as the weak side defensive end slash Jack, I don't know how deep that group is. And there's a real interesting position battle, I suppose, at strong side defensive end between Jacoby Jones, between Marquez Bimage, between whomever they would slot out there. Should they actually stick with Taquan Graham as a three technique and essentially have him battle the likes of Mauro Ajomo for the starting spot there? Anybody, Alex, you want to jump in on just your thoughts? And I'd love to hear everybody's thoughts on the personnel things that were discussed specifically with certain players, because I thought there was some really interesting stuff inside of all of that.
Yeah, well, Ketch, clearly that's what I like to go around asking about. So, with Take just hitting on a few of those things, I was just asking you guys in chat because, as you all know, I came down to the wire with me figuring out a damn babysitter for my kids to get to those availabilities. So I missed Herman's. You know, I was walking in during Herman's availability, just got there right before the start of the two coordinator availabilities and then for the assistant coaching, you know, breakout sessions. So the BJ Foster thing, that was something that as soon as you said it, that was kind of new to me, which is interesting. And what that does, honestly, with all the talk about Chris Brown and about Josh Thompson, you know, you look, I mean, I think what that means is Josh Thompson would plug in. That's just hard to say because there's also, you know, we also have the reporting from Anwar that, you know, we could be getting Anthony Cook getting a look at nickel. And if that's the case, if you move him to nickel, it's hard to decide, you know, well, Chris Brown, do you move him to the safety there in place of BJ Foster during the spring? Or is that a Josh Thompson? Because it feels like Caden Stearns is set for that other one. That'll just be an interesting discussion to have on the next time we do the defensive depth chart over there on Orange Bloods. And I'd be interested to hear what you guys think about it. I personally had Chris Brown penciled in as more of a nickel guy because that's where he played most of his snaps last year before he was injured and where he was very good last year. And Josh Thompson is more of a safety, but those guys are clearly interchangeable because Josh Thompson actually has the ability, I think as Kes just mentioned, he actually played a little bit of corner this last year. So maybe that's just something I need to think about now with this whole mix-up and right off the top of my head. But then as far as Taquan Graham, now, when I asked Coach about him, I was, you know, we've talked about it on the podcast, and it's nagged at me. Is he a proper defensive end, or has he gotten too big to where he's now a three tech? And you and I have just talked about it before offline, and we've kind of thought, look, he could be a big, beastly, strong side defensive end, but it's still kind of nagged at me. And it really made sense and it really hit home where he's like, you know, Coach Hagan was like, look, if we wanted to be, I guess if we wanted to be real stout in the run game and, we could have him out there, but we're looking to get faster on defense. We're looking to attack more. We need to be much faster on third down. It's me when I look at that guy, it's pretty clear you see a three technique. And to me, what that does is it shifts Taquan Graham into the three technique. I think that Marquez Bimage should be, clearly there will be a competition, but I don't foresee there being much of a competition between Bimage and Jacoby Jones, just based on what we've seen so far this year. I think that this opens up the idea of maybe Vernon Broughton or Myron Warren getting some work at the strong side defensive end, because now we do not need to move some of these guys who have possible strong side defensive end bodies down to the three tech, because of the three tech, we'll now have Taquan Graham and Moro Ajomo, as well as I think that the Gorham Welch, he'd probably start out at defensive end, I guess, but he seems like he has the kind of body that could eventually bump down into there. And then you also have, you know, guys like Daniel Carson, who knows whether he's going to be at the nose, whether he's going to be at the three tech. When you at the nose position, you know, you figure it's probably a Keontae Coburn, but maybe could Moro Ajomo push there? And then what do you do with Tavondre Sweat? Is he just depth there? So, look, when I look at those three spots, I honestly think whenever we should have had the idea the whole time that Taquan Graham was probably better suited to play a three tech, not only because of his body and the way he looks, but also for what it does for the rest of the group. I think it allows you to have better players across those three spots, and it also allows you to have more versatile depth.
You know, it's also fascinating to catch thinking of Osai putting his hands on the ground. I mean, because I think we clearly think, obviously, he's super talented, and we saw flashes of that. And of course, the bowl game was, a great, maybe it's coming out party. And so, kind of seeing like what that looks like when it's speaking, what Alex is saying, piggybacking off the getting faster, especially on the edge. And seeing what like he can do and Byron Vaughns can do on as edge rushers, like I think that becomes a real fascinating component of saying, okay, put some of these bigger guys, because Taquan he's big, like he's really big for an edge rusher. So putting him a little bit on the inside and having some more speed on the outside, it makes it really intriguing as far as what the defense could look like.
Jason, for me, you know, and I think Graham getting big and maybe outgrowing, you know, it's interesting to hear Alex talk about the conversation with Hagen and Hagen saying that, you know, they want to be athletic. And if they wanted to be really stout, there's some code in this, that if they wanted to be stout against the run, that they could play Graham at strong side defensive end. You know, when you're playing that three-man line and your ends are basically, you know, they're not coming off the edge as much as they're taking on blockers and holding up space and, you know, basically being lunch pail guys. And Herman talked about it a lot last year. Like, those guys weren't going to get a lot of stats. You move Graham inside suddenly at a three technique, the thing that that guy will love, all those three techniques will love, it's real hard to get a double team on that guy. I mean, it's a real hard chore to ask the center to come that far across to get involved. The tackle's got to worry about the strong side defensive end. So a lot of times you're getting one-on-one blocks. And I got to think, for a guy like Taquan Graham, he's going to have more fun potentially. All those guys that are at that three technique will probably have more fun than they did at any point last year, because they'll be given the assignment of get up the field, get in the backfield, make plays. But in taking Graham out of the equation, I looked at Alex's depth chart for like 30 minutes on Tuesday, and, you know, Marquez Benage may be the favorite to start at end now at that strong side position, and he's been a guy that has been very inconsistently – he's been very consistently inconsistent. Outside of that forced fumble that he had against, I think, Oklahoma State 2 years ago, he's not been a playmaker. And then, again, outside of Osai, you know, now you're talking about Vaughns as the backup to Osai. You're talking about Jacoby Jones as the backup potentially to Marquez Bimage. They're going to a four-man line, and it seems like we like what they potentially have at nose tackle and at the three tech. I don't know what they have at defensive end, and it's hard not to think about their failures in recruiting.
Look, so you got a couple really good freshmen coming in, but that's a lot of those guys.
Yeah. And they may have to play like that. I felt like the door kind of opens up potentially for an Alfred Collins if you're taking, you know, because if you've got Graham as a strong side defensive end and Bimage blocking him as a backing him up, then Collins shows up and there's a little bit of older provenness in front of him. There's not a lot of that though. Bimage is older, but he's not really proven. And it could be that for a guy like Broughton or a guy like Collins, that this opens up the door for them to get some snaps that they wouldn't have otherwise. Or if a guy like Broughton is stuck inside, it may be tougher for him to get on the field, knowing that, you know, at the three tech, he's got to fight off both a Jomo and Graham to get on the field. It seems like end and linebacker is where my question marks for this defense are, after hearing the coaches talk about where they envision the personnel being.
Can I say just real quick about Bimage? I'm sorry, he had a big game versus Tech to end the season too. It wasn't just the game versus Tech was, he had a sack, he had a quarterback hit, he had a pressure, a batted pass, he caused a fumble, he recovered a fumble, and he had a bunch of tackles.
Let the record show that in the last 2 years, he's had one game of substance.
I'm just saying.
For the record, let the record show that he did have that one game against Texas Tech.
Let the record show it took Todd Orlando to that game to figure out how to use his
Go ahead, Jason.
No, you got to remember, of course, Vernon Broughton's on campus already, so they'll tinker with him this spring. I just think there's, you know, we're looking for answers now that I don't think the coaches even know until they get out there this spring. I mean, and I'll throw this wrench into the mix. I mean, I talked to a recruit this week, defensive line recruit, and he was on campus a couple weeks ago, and I'll put this in the war room, but he was told, hey, that they might still run predominantly. And I know they said otherwise on Tuesday. They said it's going to be a four-man front, but they were telling him, and this was 3 weeks ago, so maybe their opinions have changed now that they've gotten more acquainted with their roster, but they were telling him, hey, we'll probably still run predominantly or more, I guess, not predominantly, but maybe slightly more than half three-man fronts, because they don't think they have – at the time, they didn't think they had the personnel to completely change it up to a four-man front. You heard Tom Herman mention on Tuesday, hey, four down. You heard him talk about Baylor you know, they kind of flex even when they're three down, they flex their ends out. I mean, there's different ways you can attack this. I think, and I believe it, you know, I don't remember if it was Ash or Yursich that said it's, I think it might have been Yursich, but the same applies to defense. I mean, you've got to kind of scheme around what your talent is. You can't take a bunch of square pegs and try to fit them into a round hole. So, you know, everybody's obsessed and we're kind of just assuming, hey, it is going to be whatever, 90% four down on the defense. I'm not quite there yet. I think, I don't know that their personnel quite matches up with that. You know, I think there's a lot of tinkering that's going to go on in the spring, including, you know, the guys we've talked about, including Verdon Broughton, including when Alfred Collins gets there in the fall. Sawyer Gorham Welch is already there this on campus. So I think there's a lot of moving parts in this, and I just I'm not locked in on any particular player rotation. I'm not even locked in on any particular scheme yet, and I don't know that the coaches are either. I think they'll kind of have to kind of figure that out on the fly once they get to spring ball in about a month.
Did anybody else think it was interesting that Herman seemed to play the Orange Bloods message board's greatest hits and his comments about the defensive line? They wanted more of a pass rush. It was better for recruiting. You know, like he was rattling off all these things that move made, the reason why it made sense. They didn't want to be stubborn. They wanted to be able to be versatile. And you know, it was like, yes, like those are things that literally we're talking about, you know, until our faces turn blue a year ago. Don't be stubborn. Get more. But
didn't he also say, hey, we won't be stubborn with a four-man front? Or am I misremembering that?
Well, I think the message was they wanted to be versatile and to be able to do anything based on the game, the opponent, the situation. You know, I don't think anybody is opposed to playing some three-man front. I think they were you know, married to it to such a degree a year ago.
I'll be curious. Alex, when you chart the games, one more thing to add to your list.
You're going to give him this one?
Yeah, I'd be curious to just see it charted, maybe the first two or three games, how often they are in four down versus three. You know, I don't know. Is it going to be 90-10? Is it going to be 55-45? You know, I don't know. It'll be really interesting to see how that.
I mean, since there is like a jack position now, that'll be easy. I can add a column for that. Yeah.
What about on the offensive side of the ball? You know, I mean, Rashawn Johnson stays at running back. I think, I mean, my God, that just is common sense in my mind. Jordan Whittington goes to the slot. It didn't feel necessarily like the personnel discussion there was quite as dramatic as some of the stuff that we were talking about on the defensive side of the ball. Anwar, in terms of Coleman and Yursich and how those guys talked about what they wanted to do on offense, it felt more like the messaging was, we're going to be a lot more like, this isn't going to be a drastic change. The terminology is going to remain the same as much as humanly possible. We like what we're doing on offense. But boy, they needed an actual play caller. And I love the fact that Yursich like used phrasing like, I get off on calling plays.
That was the highlight of the press conference
for me,
dude.
That was definitely the highlight.
Was it me, Anwar? Like, you're in the room. Did that kind of seem to like, because everybody kind of laughed. It was like, it's almost like when he said it, he's like, oh shit, did I just say that? It kind of threw off his rhythm for the next couple minutes, I felt like, after he said that.
Yeah. It was definitely, it was like, oh, he did say that.
Did I just say that on national television?
That clearly was a guy who hasn't been interviewed in like a couple of years. And this was like, oh, I forgot. Like, yeah, we could definitely expect some more John Bianco prepping before his Yursich press conference is going forward. But
But the thing with Yursich on war is that like the knock, and not really knock, the frustration for him is that he takes the Ohio State job, but like he's not calling plays a year ago. And then at Oklahoma State, even though he was calling plays, there was always this feeling of not him not having full control because Gundy, and I would probably say more right than wrong, because that's his side of the ball as well, a bit of a micromanager there. Like, you know, I thought it was refreshingly honest that Yursich was so hyped up about doing that because it's the one thing that he hasn't had full and complete control of. And it seems that Herman has said, like, we're going to work together and, you know, I want to be involved, but I need someone to call the plays and be in control on game days. And as Yurcich put it, like, he gets off on that. Like, he probably hasn't done it enough now enough lately that he's really going to look forward to that. And that for the first time in the Tom Herman era, someone openly said, I'm the play caller.
Well, yeah. And, you know, like to your point, like that's what he wants, right? So, you know, to unpack it, right? So I asked Coach Herman, hey, all right, so trying to get an understanding of, okay, is this going to be Yurcich, you know, playbook per se, or is he just going to be running your offense? And then he kind of, you know, gives this explanation that it's not really someone comes in with a playbook, but it's basically ideas and concepts and they all work together. You know, so I don't know how to totally address that other than them saying, okay, this is what we ran before. This is what we're probably going to continue to run. So if we're looking for like a layman's terms, it's probably like, hey, you know, running a lot of what Tom did, but having his own spin. But yeah, it's a thing that he just hasn't wanted to do. I think what worked well and worked best for him was when he was at Houston and he had Major Applewhite calling plays for him on offense, and he had Todd Orlando handling the defense, and he was kind of that the overseer, you know, portion of it. It shows and it speaks a lot to what Major Applewhite was able to do, able to accomplish, where Herman was like, yeah, I need that again in order for me to have the level of success that I want. And so he has a guy that wants to do it, who he feels confident in doing it. And in many ways, he's going to have to let him do it because Tom Herman has to jump in, you know, after, you know, well, they don't play Maryland, but if he has to jump in at any point over the next couple of years, then this thing is not going well. And this thing is probably heading in a really bad direction. So, you know, having a guy that, you know, wants to do, is confident in doing it, has also been in this conference before and understands the, you know, the importance of the, you know, putting up points in the Big 12. It'll be interesting, you know, to see when it's fourth down, you know, who makes that call, you know, does, you know, when it's fourth and two, fourth and three, I mean, does Tom, you know, say we're still going for it? Does Yurcich, you know, it'll be interesting to see what those dynamics will ultimately be. But, you know, but it was also fascinating, you know, when he started talking about like 11 personnel and will he be running that or not? And he kind of just didn't seem married. You know, to that, just seemed to be like saying, like, hey, whatever gets the ball moving, whatever gets them down the field, it's kind of seems to be the also thing. And also, he was asked about like the, you know, the tempo and run pass splits and things to that effect. And so, it doesn't seem like he's married to particular concepts at this point. But you know, like anything, right now, Ketch, and you guys know this well. You've done this for years. It's you're loved now, but let wait till, you know, September. And let there be a couple of three and outs and you become the most hated guy on the board. So, you know, enjoy the honeymoon right now because the marriage comes when the season starts.
Yeah, going back real quick onward to your 11 personnel comment. And he was asked about that and he, you know, kind of went into a little bit of a describing his philosophy of, you know, players, plays or formations or it was something like that, but the players came first. And that to me was one of the most interesting things of that entire day was that was kind of a common theme with all of those guys. I think Ash basically said the exact same thing, like, you know, like he said something like players are more important than plays. And it was kind of refreshing to hear because I think Texas in the past has gotten a little too fixated on scheme and formations and not players. You know, I kind of have those visions in my head of Kyle Porter in third down situations. And we're all wondering, why is he on the field being asked to do something that he's not the best at? And it was like Texas was trying to just use Jedi mind tricks on the defense and throw him off because Kyle Porter was out there to break tendons, something like that. So I thought it was pretty refreshing to hear when those guys were asked about personnel and scheme and formations and all these things that they all collectively kind of just went back to, hey, it's about the players and us using the players the best way, because I think that's something that Texas hasn't done a great job of in the past.
Dustin, I want to stick with you on this, but I'm really throwing this out to everyone. And I don't mean this in a negative way. Because it doesn't have to be necessarily answered that way. But was there anything that you didn't hear on Tuesday from any of the coaches that stood out to you in any shape, form, or fashion? Something that you were either expecting them to talk about, or something that you hoped that they would talk about, or something that they touched on briefly but didn't go in deep on? Anything that wasn't said on Tuesday, since we've spent a lot of time talking about the things that were said?
Not really. I think one of the things that stood out to me is I can't remember who it was. I think it might have been Ash, that when he was kind of going through just the general position groups on defense, I think it was him that basically labeled the linebacker group as, I think he used the word thin. And in my head, I was like, oh my gosh, this might be a bigger problem than even we're realizing, even though we're talking up the lack of depth at the linebacker position. If he, in his first press conference setting, when describing the position groups of going through, is like freely admitting that that is an issue on defense, this might be a bigger issue than we think, heading into spring football and heading into next season, and that these guys desperately need to go out and try to get somebody in the graduate transfer market. But no, there wasn't one thing that they didn't talk about or didn't answer that I was kind of like dying to hear about. I think generally that they covered a lot of things and kind of gave a good glimpse into, you know, the thought process and things like that. I thought for the most part, all those guys were just kind of very honest and gave thoughtful responses about, hey, this is what we're going to try to do moving forward. And, you know, just trying to maximize the personnel as best we can.
Alex, what about you? And speaking to, I mean, you know, like I said, it doesn't necessarily have to be negative. It was just, there anything that wasn't talked about on Tuesday?
The whole time Dustin was answering, I was kind of glad you asked him, because I'm having trouble thinking of something that I didn't hear talked about. The things that I was interested in hearing about, asked.
That's good. Yeah. I asked the question just to make sure that I ask it in the event that there's something insightful that we haven't tapped into. But the answer could quite honestly be no. Anwar, I thought it was refreshing that, you know, one of the things that stood out to me on Tuesday is I thought Tuesday was a good day for the Texas football program. I thought that allowing us to see these guys, I saw Anthony Geronimo from KI42 did like a mashup of different answers that different guys gave to different questions. And like Jay Valai was talking about Whataburger, and he's like, there's two things that matter in the state of Texas, Whataburger and Texas football. And, you know, he was like talking about his go-to Whataburger meal. And
his Whataburger promo was awesome.
But like, we're not going to get these guys a lot. Like, that's not really Tom Herman's MO, is to let us spend a lot of time with his assistants. So I really appreciated Tuesday that that they stopped and said, hey, let's have a meet and greet. Let's let everybody get to see these guys. And I hope coming out of that, I don't have anticipation that we will, but I hope over the course of the next season, you know, from now through December, that they give us another moment or two, either before the start of the season or something during the spring. Like, I hope that they make those guys available again, because I didn't think that anything other than good things transpired on Tuesday. You know, like, that's not a bad thing. It's okay to have days in the football program where other voices are heard. And if you trust your staff, like, you can let those guys talk, I suppose.
Yeah. I mean, well, first of all, we probably won't speak to these guys again.
Ever.
Maybe next year or something like that, potentially. But, I think that's probably a wrap, right? And so we'll just get your
damn it.
But you know what? But you know what struck me, honestly, Ketch, is, you know, with the exception of Valai, right? When I talked to these guys, and maybe Alex kind of felt the same thing, like, I felt like these were guys talking from experience. I felt like these were guys talking from Power 5 experience, right? And you just did not have that with Herman's initial staff. Like, you had a bunch of guys who, you know, look, there was this guy from Houston, and it's a hard thing when you become a head coach and you had guys who help you get to a bigger stage. You kind of feel like you want to reach back and bring them along with you. But then sometimes, you know, it doesn't necessarily work out the way that you hope so for. And then I felt like, you know, whether it's Ash, you feel like, okay, this guy's proven, he's got a national title, you know, ring check. You know, you look at Yurcich and it's like, all right, he worked at Oklahoma State. He worked under Mike Gundy, who is a fantastic coach. Check, right? And you just kind of go down, okay, Boulware, you know, he worked over at Oklahoma, done special teams over there, so he has special teams on his resume. Check. Hagen has been at a major program. You know what I'm saying? Like, you could go down the line of Eliza. The only guy that you say is, like, the only guy who's kind of, you know, quote unquote, unproven, but he's the guy that Chris Ash is willing to stand on the table. And out of all the guys that he would could have brought here to Texas, that's the one guy that he's decided to bring. So I just look at, yeah, I think if you're a Texas fan, should have a little bit of optimism, because it almost seems like, you know, maybe not person for person, but it almost seems like from a resume standpoint and experience standpoint, these are probably some of the guys he should have had initially, but these are some of the guys that he has now. And if those guys can find a way to mesh together, and you also have guys who have something to prove, like you have a guy like Ash, who, look, I mean, he got fired and he didn't last a whole year. So to say that that guy doesn't have something to prove, I mean, he has something to prove. You have Yurcich, who, you know, was an OC at Oklahoma State. And then he comes in here and he goes to Ohio State, but he's not calling plays there. He comes here. He finally has an opportunity, Power Five school. He's got something to prove. And all these guys, to a certain degree and certain levels, have something to prove, but they also had experience to go along with it. So that just kind of one of my biggest takeaways coming out of that day.
Jason, should we have a follow-up conversation on recruiting? I realize that could very easily be a parting shot kind of topic, but given that the Rivals rankings have changed, given that we've moved into 2021, given that, I think that there's a big picture conversation about 2021 recruiting that I'm not sure that most Texas fans completely understand. And that is the difficult dynamic of so many people being in kind of a wait and see. Like we have described the Brockermeyers, for instance, and being in a little bit of a wait and see mode, but it's really difficult because they're wait and see in February, but what they're waiting to see, they might not wait for ultimately.
Well, a lot of those guys want to commit this summer. So
yes. So it's hard to, yeah. If a guy says, hey, I'm going to wait and see mode with Texas, but the thing they're waiting to see comes after the moment they ideally want to make a decision. I think someone on the message board in this discussion mentioned that of the top 15 guys in state last year, I think only three or four of them made their decisions after the season started. So, and one of those is like a guy like Zach Evans, who, you know, what the hell is going on with Zach Evans?
Go ahead and sign anyway.
But so, you know, it's a limited group of guys that will wait to see what Texas does before they actually make their decisions. And so it's hard to talk about this 2021 class without sounding somewhat pessimistic, but it's not pessimism as much as it's just acknowledging the reality that exists right now. And as I wrote about this in my 10 thoughts from the weekend, it's a bit of a free for all right now. Every single, there's no trend that can be followed right now, that every kid's got his own recruitment and there's nothing to lean on right now to say, well, Texas has got all this momentum. So, you know, or Texas A&M for that matter, that, you know, that they can lean on when it comes time for these kids to make their decisions. This will be probably a lot like last year in the final stages, the final 5-6 months after Texas had that run in July and August. From then on, most of it was done, but what happened from there wasn't any rhyme or reason from individual recruitment to recruitment that suggested you could accurately predict what was going to happen, right? We got into this thing in the final week when we were trying to predict where guys were going to go. There weren't trends to follow. And so we have a period of time until someone assumes control the way it looked like Texas might have been 8 months ago.
That's assuming somebody does. They may not again this year.
And maybe this is the beginning of this new trend, that it's a free-for-all every year, because until Texas or Texas A&M get really good, because think about a year ago, they were both – Texas was 10 in the preseason rankings and A&M was 12. And we were all talking about how there had never been a year where Oklahoma, Texas, and Texas A&M had all been good in the same year.
and they still haven't been good in the same year. But Oklahoma wins another conference championship, and they were an afterthought in the state of Texas. Texas and Texas A&M had disappointing seasons. A&M makes all their bacon going out of state for the most part. Texas actually had a pretty respectable in-state haul without any success outside of Bijan Robinson out of state. I don't know how to like predict where this thing goes.
Well, it just shows you what a missed opportunity that was for Texas last year. I mean, if Texas plays better on the field, I mean, they are probably dominating in-state recruiting in 2021. And that may not be the case now. I mean, they have, I guess they're down to six commitments now after Lake McCree decommitted. And, you know, Texas has three, I believe, of the top 15 in the state committed, neither A&M nor LSU or Oklahoma. I need to pull up the updated rankings, but I don't think any one of the other three even have a single commitment in the top 15 from the state of Texas. But you're right, it's you've got guys like the Brockermeyer brothers, you know, a lot of other players saying, hey, I want to kind of wait and see how Texas does. But then yet, you know, the Brockermeyer brothers have told me, hey, I want to probably commit sometime this summer. And that's a danger. You know, people say, oh, well, that's fine. You know, if they go somewhere else and, you know, Texas goes out and wins 10 games next year, though, they can flip them. Maybe, but that's a dangerous game to play, man. You don't want to have to rely on that. I mean, you know, Texas fans always think they can flip just about any player, and that just doesn't happen quite as often as people probably think it does. So it's just an interesting position. You know, last year was such an anomaly with Texas for the 2020 and 2021 classes. I mean, I don't remember the numbers, but it was like 20-something commitments in a, what was it, a three-month, two-and-a-half-month span. I mean, literally, they were averaging like 2 to 3 commitments a week there for about a month and a half. That was an anomaly. And I think this year, man, you're looking at it. I think there's one guy who could pop pretty soon for Texas, but I don't think we're going to see a big run-up of commitments, you know, certainly this spring or this summer the way we did last year. You'll see a couple. You know, a couple guys will probably come in for official visits in, you know, April, May, maybe June. And those are guys that just want to be at Texas come hell or high water. I mean, those guys are going to probably commit regardless. But I don't think we're certainly not going to see that big run like we did last year, where you're going to see, let's say, you know, 2/3 of the 2021 class commit this summer, and then a bunch of even 2022 guys commit this summer. That's kind of what we saw last year. It's just it's a different vibe. You're right, Ketch. You wrote about it, LSU did what it needed to do to kind of seize some momentum, and LSU is going to be a thorn in UT's side. It hasn't quite bubbled up to the surface yet, but it will. LSU will be a player with a lot of in-state guys, but Texas and Texas A&M in particular, either one of those schools could have taken a massive step forward in terms of in-state dominance, and neither one did what they needed to do. And, you know, I tell you, this year's going to be interesting because A&M has a pretty easy schedule, a front-loaded schedule that's pretty easy. So they should start off pretty, you know, with a pretty attractive record. Can they parlay that into recruiting success? I don't know. I mean, I think most of us feel Texas is going to be much better than they were last year. If Texas can get by LSU and string together some early wins, and you know, they're looking at 5-0 or something to start the season, then I mean Texas could be the in-state recruiting juggernaut then. But what happens if half those top 15-ish type guys are off the board? Then you're counting on flipping them. And again, I said it earlier, I'm not saying it can't happen, but it's not as easy. It's not the position you want to be in. So interesting dynamics. You know, I think everybody's just almost trading body blows right now, and then maybe this fall, maybe one of the teams can kind of go for a knockout punch if they can have success on the field. But right now, I think, you know, Texas and probably A&M too are kind of just treading water for the next few months.
Do you think one of those two schools cares more about the other, about this?
I think we all know the answer to that. I mean, I think Texas, regardless of what A&M does, I think Texas is going to recruit well, okay? If Texas can turn into – you know, Goliath the way they were, it was when Mac Brown was there, then A&M doesn't have much of a chance. I mean, they'll get one or two guys here or there, of course. But, yeah, I think A&M needs to be much more concerned about Texas, you know, taking control of the state than Texas does A&M taking control of the state.
Who needs to be, you know, because I'm still – it's funny because Herman talked about how proud they were to have – so many Texas kids in this. It was is basically the opposite of what he said 2 years ago.
Yet they're offering out of state kids like I mean, it's crazy the number of out of state offers they're throwing out of the last few weeks. So
no, I know. So I guess my question was more along the lines of those two. Is there ones, and maybe the answer is still A&M. Is there a school that needs to be better out of state than the other? I probably contend they both need to be really damn good out of state.
Probably more Oklahoma. I mean, I know we're talking about Texas and Texas A&M, but I mean, Oklahoma, I mean, they do take, and it seems even more under Lincoln Riley, they take more of a national recruiting approach. They always did, even under Bob Stoops, they recruited out west in Arizona and California pretty well. But, you know, I don't know. I think Texas and A&M can still kind of make their bacon predominantly recruiting in-state. You know, it's a really good question, man. A&M has some out-of-state cachet just because they're in the SEC. They can go into some of those pockets in the southeastern portion of the country and recruit pretty well. I still think Texas, and we're seeing it this year, they've also offered some Arizona kids, some California kids, some Georgia area kids. There are certain pockets, I think, that work well for each school, but I don't think either school can be a legitimate college football playoff-type contender without dominating – in-state recruiting, and I don't think either one's doing it just yet.
You mentioned it, but it'll be interesting in 5 months from now to look at what the school commitment breakdowns look like for this 2021 class. But of the top 20 kids in the state right now, 25% of them are, I guess maybe 30% are already committed. So you've got three are committed to Texas, one to Ohio State, one to Alabama, one to Texas A&M, one to SMU. You've got no Homan,
this is the top 30 or something.
I'm looking at the top 20.
Top 20, okay.
Top 20. So really, it looks like 35% because there's seven commitments. Three of them to Texas, and then there are four others that are scattered around between Ohio State, Alabama, A&M, and SMU. It'll be interesting once the decisions, by the time the start of the football season begins and most of these decisions have been made, if it's as scattershot or, you know, can someone – Texas is the school to me that has a chance to do it. It's just going to be tough, right? Because it's looking like they could regain Quay Davis, which would give them, you know, three of the top six in Texas, which is exactly
four of the top ten.
Yeah, that's starting to get into the territory of what they need to be doing every year.
They're in a good spot with LJ Johnson, who's number nine. I've got the list pulled up in front of me. The Brockermeyer brothers, Kamar Wheaton, they're in contention for Bryce Foster. I mean, you know, listen, if Texas had won 10 games last year, I mean,
I'm with you, yeah.
They might have hit 9 out of 10 of the top 10, honestly. Latrell McCutcheon would probably be the only one they wouldn't get. I mean, they could have probably even landed Donovan Jackson potentially. So it was just a missed opportunity. But listen, I mean, I sound like a glass half empty guy probably, as usual. On Morris sitting there thinking, yeah, as usual. I mean, it's they didn't strike while the iron was hot. But, you know, it's no need to panic. Certainly Texas can still have a tremendous – 2021 recruiting class largely on in-state prospects.
I'm going to give you my most negative take of the day, and then we'll go into parting shots. The Brockermeyer thing. What stands out to me about the Brockermeyer thing is they're taking a wait-and-see approach, but they've got a brother who's in the program already. And what Texas isn't getting with having a brother in the program already is the benefit of the doubt that they're going to get there. So it feels like my interpretation of this is that whatever the father Blake is looking at, whatever Tommy's looking at, whatever is going on, it feels like the messaging that they're feeling from and look, maybe this is just obvious. Like last season, they fired seven coaches, so it couldn't have been awesome inside the program. But it feels like when they say that there's certain things or there's a vibe, that there's certain things that they're looking for, they're not getting a firm affirmation from inside the program from the guy who's related to them that can give it to them best. It's just one thing that I can't quite shake. Is that
it's hard to fault them, honestly, if you're
being fair. It's fair.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, listen, he knows more about this stuff than probably me and anybody else. And he's been recruited. He's been a coach. He's been at the NFL. I mean, blah, blah, blah. I mean, they know what they're looking for. I mean, and frankly, I think and they haven't told me this, but I think in their heart of hearts, they would love it to be Texas. But when they look at Texas and the maybe some of the instability, and then you look at the Alabamas and Georgias and, you know, Clemson, although Clemson hasn't offered James yet, but, you know, it's kind of understandable, man. They're looking for places they can get developed, compete for championships, have some stability. And frankly, there are other places that have that, certainly more so than Texas does. So, you know, you kind of understand what they're doing, but it would still be a bitter, bitter pill for Texas if they can't land those two.
Real quick, did I ever tell you about this? I know I've told this story before, but since we're talking about Blake, did I ever tell you about the time I got confused with Blake Brockermeyer and a kid asked for my autograph?
No.
I was working in the Texas SID office, and after a game, I can't remember what game it was, but after a game back in 94, I come downstairs out of Belmont Hall. I'm going to my car, and this kid walks up, you know, with his dad, small kid, maybe like 7, 8 years old.
And he must be small, because how tall is Blake Brockermeyer?
He's like 6'7". He's like 5'10". This kid
must have thought, been looking up to you and thinking you were real tall.
Yeah. He comes up to me and goes, "Mr. Brockermeyer, can I have your autograph?"
You're like, "Yeah, how do I spell Brockermeyer?"
I signed that shit Blake Brockermeyer. I didn't sign Jeff Ketchum. I didn't want to ruin that little kid's dream. I signed his football Blake Brockermeyer.
Oh, my goodness.
I didn't have the heart to tell him that the guy he was looking for was, you know, almost a foot taller than me. <That's
funny>. Is there a K in Brockermeyer? He's kidding, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Why is there an I in Brockermeyer? Let's do it. Let's go into parting shots. Anwar, it's been a while since we've heard from you. You want to lead us off?
Sure. You know, I'll end with the, you know, of course, I'll have, you know, a lot of the interview stuff that I had from the assistants in the war room. The one thing, two things that, I'll just worth highlighting now. Jay Boulware, you know, obviously when he's at Oklahoma, you know, was asked about, well, what was that conversation like with Lincoln Riley when you told him you were going to Texas? And he goes, next question. And it was just like that. They're like, oh, really? So, you know, it's kind of one of those, like, how soon did your key card stop working when you told them that you were going to Texas? So that, I found that to be really interesting. And the last one is really, you know, sometimes there's a human element when it comes to these coaches that you just don't really recognize, because it's just kind of what they do. It's their job. It's kind of like how we are at sometimes, like people don't necessarily, you know, have a human element as relates to us. But you know, there is, because, and so, you know, just talking to a guy like Hagan, and that's something that I had reported earlier, but I was able to kind of flush this out. You know, just thinking that when he left College Station and took that job at Indiana, you know, his family went up there with him, and it just didn't work out for them. He had daughters. They were in school. They had activities that they were already plugged into. And they just decided as a family that, you know, they would just part ways, and she would move back to College Station so they could get the kids back into their activities, and he would stay up there in Indiana. And that occurred back in 2016, and here it is, he's finally has a chance to be reunited with his family, but them having to do FaceTimes and, you know, them trying to maybe fly up. He said there will at least be one family member up, you know, for a home game, not for the road games, but just a sacrifice that the family had to make. It's for them to actually finally be reunited right now. Was kind of a cool thing, kind of a, you know, touching moment for me, just again putting that human element that we don't always do on coaches. So glad for the Hagan family that they are finally get their dad around, and you know, he's got several daughters, so him to be actually be around them, to go to their activities and stuff like that, kind of a cool moment.
That's hard living, man.
Yeah,
I mean, I can't imagine. I don't like being away from my kids for like my kids went out of town this weekend for a couple of days, and I missed them. Like that's a tough one. What about you, Alex? You got a parting shot for us?
Well, happy Valentine's to everybody. It's just the best goddamn holiday for us men, right? Just a dream come true.
I love the sarcasm.
Just come on. Was Valentine's really made up by the Hallmark Company or by Bed Bath & Beyond? or somebody.
Well, it's a good thing we don't have any other artificial holidays, like one that features a bunny or one that features us getting dressed up to go get candy or one.
Well, at least the one with the bunny has significance to like a large portion of religious people. It's like, what is Valentine's even?
It's about what love. Is it? I'm going to stand up to you on this one. There's nothing wrong with having a day completely dedicated, because most people don't go out of their way to show love every day. Most men, husband, women, wives, they don't go out of their way on a daily basis to show love, to tell someone, I love you, to do something nice, to give their wives flowers. And if it takes a designated day to force a guy to be a little more loving than normal,
like, then you're a bad husband. You're a bad husband.
Here's the thing. I think this. I thought I was being a fucking good husband because I had the idea to get. Have you guys seen the commercials for this goddamn Waterpik, like Sonicare toothbrush? Where it's like you can brush your teeth with like a nice Sonicare toothbrush, but embedded inside of it is this goddamn thing that's supposed to floss your teeth with like this water flosser thing, right? And so I was thinking, I'm like, well, these things each cost like $160. That'd be a nice thing though, because my wife, I figure she's probably into oral care, right? But like she'd been complaining about some kind of toothbrush. So, but before I go and spend all this goddamn money on the toothbrush, I was like, you know what? It might ruin a surprise, but maybe I should ask her about this toothbrush. You know, like would you want it? Like if I give it to you, is it gonna be somewhere I gotta fucking go take this thing back because it's got this or it's the wrong this or the wrong that, or you've been looking at toothbrushes, but you've been looking at this other one, this different brand, all this stuff. And so I bring it up to her, and now all we've had is nitpicking the features of this goddamn product that I was just going to buy her, and maybe there's something out there that's better, and maybe like, so now I'm just stuck with my dick in my hand, not even knowing if I'm going to have to go buy this present, because here's the thing. Now I know once I buy it for her, she's going to say, well, I've looked into the battery charge and this is not very long, and like, but I haven't been given an alternative, right? And so I think if you're going to be a good husband and you're going to go get a gift and all this stuff, my advice to you would be, don't ask your wife beforehand. If she doesn't like it, she doesn't like it. But you're going to find yourself in this fucking gift-giving limbo of saying, all right, I can give her a gift that I already know she's kind of been a little bit lukewarm on, because she's pointed out to me the features about it that she doesn't like, but has not given me a viable alternative in this same realm.
You could do what my buddy did for Valentine's Day. He gave his wife laundry, and she was so pissed. She goes, this is a present for you, dumbass.
Not for her laundry?
Lingerie.
Lingerie. Oh, yeah, lingerie. So, okay, yeah, that's probably like, just as bad.
Yeah. Yeah, I did think he said laundry, by the way.
Oh, my bad.
Like,
my bad.
I thought like he took a basket of clothes and was like, wash them, woman.
That'd be worse.
Alex, my advice to you would be, if you know that your wife is lukewarm is the word that you used.
Well, she feels lukewarm. It's like, oh, she's
pointed out to me. Well, why shouldn't she? Like, it's a toothbrush.
No, it's a toothbrush combined with a Waterpik flosser.
This is your Valentine's
Day.
It's like buying her a Peloton bike.
It sounds like you need Valentine's Day.
No, here's the other thing. I've already told her that her big Valentine's gift is the new trolling motor that's coming from my kayak, because that's going to mean a whole lot of fresh crappie fish very, very soon.
Oh, my good God. For her.
I She's feel like you're going to love them my motor. Case for me, Alex. You're you know making what? My case.
I was going to go against Ketch initially, but now I've switched. Like, I need to totally do my drunk uncle, because Alex's wife is getting screwed right now. But this
let
is
me tell you how this should work. This will be my parting shot. And, Alex, let me tell you, this is supposed to work. So, my wife is a huge book nerd. I mean, huge. Like, she reads, I don't know how many books a week. I don't know how the hell she does. I don't read books at all. So anyways, there's this famous bookstore in Los Angeles. We had a puzzle that she did of it. It has these books and it makes like arches and tunnels and shit. And she's wanted to go to this bookstore forever. It's just whatever. It's her crazy ass dream. But okay, I don't understand it, but she wants to do it. So for her birthday / Valentine's Day, we're using points. And I told you this a long time ago. We're actually flying out to LA tomorrow late afternoon, going to fly back Sunday morning. It'd be a very quick trip. But on Saturday, I was like, you know, honey, You go to that bookstore, live it up. I'll go hit a bar somewhere here at the bookstore, and then we'll go have dinner Saturday night, fly home Sunday morning, dude. That's a Valentine's gift, brother, and I'm going to get crazy, wild, kinky sex, I hope, out of it. So that's how Valentine's is supposed to work, right?
Jeez.
It doesn't work that way for a toothpick or a water pick or whatever.
A water pick. No. But the water pick flosser is inside of the Sonicare toothbrush. This is the gift of oral health.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, my gosh.
What do you want when you're 70 years old? Some memory of a bookstore or to have your teeth not rotted out?
Well, I hope my wife takes care of her teeth anyways. So
You're basically saying your wife doesn't brush her teeth and take care of them.
Oh, she brushes her teeth. Now
you. But you're giving her a gift on like the day of love. I mean, like
on the day of love, you're like, do better.
the big gift, right? The big gift is the trolling motor for the kayak.
Does she ride in the kayak a bunch or something?
Oh wow! You're going to get some mad sex for that one, Alex. Golly!
I can't wait till you use your new motor, honey.
Oh my gosh. She's going to tell me you're going to cook the fish for it, but it won't be for that kayak. I thought
I knew how to destroy a good marriage. Alex, you can take the lead. Go for it.
Dustin, your parting shot.
Oh, well, I'm doing Valentine's Day tonight because I'll be in Houston on Friday for the Rice Texas baseball series this weekend to open up the college baseball season. Yeah. Other than that, I'm with you, Ketch. I think it's a good day to just put love to the forefront and, you know, kind of remind everybody that it can never hurt to show some love and do some nice things, especially for your significant other. But looking forward to the start of baseball season, which hopefully is a good distraction from whatever it is the basketball program is right now.
My parting shot, because Jason's seemingly was about getting some crazy sex.
Mine was so sweet until the very end, wasn't it?
You were doing so well until your motivations were.
Oh yeah, exactly.
I'm merely going to say, look up the word pampered, guys. I'm talking massages. I'm talking day spas. I'm talking mani-pedis. I'm talking about do something that you don't normally do. And if you do all those things already, then fine. But most men don't. Don't go for the toothbrush. Don't go for the flowers. Go buy your wife flowers on March 14th. Show her that you want to buy her flowers on days not designated as cliche days for flowers. On the day of love, on the day of Valentine's, skip the cliches and pamper her in whatever way she prefers to be pampered. And if she doesn't love to be pampered because she's never been pampered, pamper her and see where it goes. See if she likes it, because at the end of the day, she's going to be telling her friends, they're going to compare and contrast what their men did for them on Valentine's Day. And this is where Alex has to be very careful, because his wife is going to tell her friends that he bought her a fucking toothbrush. And it may be a fancy toothbrush, but it's a toothbrush nonetheless. And if she talks to a friend and is like, oh, he got me, my husband let me go to Lake Austin Spa and I got to pick any three different things that I want. So I got a massage, and then I had this little minty lunch thing where they brought out drinks and tea and my friends do. Here's an idea. Like, set it up. I once did this for a girl that I dated. Let buy her and her best friend a day or an evening, like at Shazy for lunch on a Sunday or brunch on a Sunday, where they can go by themselves without the kids, without the husbands, and they can go and eat whatever they want and have drinks and be pampered on and have flowers brought out to them at the dinner, and let them feel like it's not some angle for you to get something. Be creative. Be creative. Don't go buy anything off of a shelf. That would be my advice on Valentine's Day. And on that note, I better follow my own advice. For myself and Jason and Alex and Dustin and Anwar. Anwar, you do anything for Valentine's Day this year?
Nope. No need. No need.
Go buy yourself a toothbrush.
Alex Bly's got a promo code he's trying to use.
Yeah, he's probably. I'm sure. I'm a little surprised there's not like some Amway hook on this. Like, not only can you get one, but you can buy it through my own discount code. Go toothbrush Alex, and you can save 20%. For all of us, good luck, fellas, tomorrow. Do the right thing. Don't be lazy. And thanks for listening to the Ticket City Podcast. I'll always remind everybody, call or email Chris, common spelling, C-H-R-I-S, at TicketCity.com. Let your Orange Blood subscription pay for itself by taking advantage of the special prices on tickets. And this isn't just an Austin thing, guys. We're going to be promoting Houston Rodeo coming up soon. If you want to go see Lizzo, take advantage of that Orange Bloods discount, get your tickets from Ticket City, and then it's like you're on Orange Bloods for free, which will make you feel a lot better than this notion that you're giving me money, which I know half of you hate. So again, on behalf of everybody on the staff, thanks for listening. We'll do it again next week. Later.